This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Our Howison lecturer for this year is Fred Dretzky, one of the leading figures on the contemporary scene working on problems in the areas of epistemology and philosophy of mind. Professor Dretzky received the BSEE degree in electrical engineering from Purdue University in 1954. His graduate studies were conducted at the University of Minnesota, where he was awarded the MA degree in philosophy in 1958 and the PhD in 1960, also in philosophy, with a minor in mathematics. Professor Dretzky taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison from 1960 to 1990 and at Stanford University from 1990 to 1998. At the latter institution, he was the Bella and Eloise Mayberry Knapp Professor of Philosophy. He now holds the title of Professor Emeritus from both Wisconsin and Stanford. And in addition, since 1999, Professor Dretzky has been affiliated with Duke University as a senior research scholar. Professor Dretzky's work has focused on some of the central issues in contemporary epistemology and philosophy of mind, and his contributions have had a profound effect on the contemporary understanding of these issues. An animating concern of his has been to make sense of knowledge, rational action, and conscious experience in naturalistic terms as phenomena that are possible in a materialistic world. Professor Dretzky defends a form of externalism in both epistemology and philosophy of mind, arguing that the contents of thought and experience are fixed in part by the external, i.e., causal and historical, relations between subject and environment. For instance, he's proposed a non-epistemic account of the content of visual experience, according to which we see many things that we do not notice at the time when we see them. Similarly, knowledge, on Professor Dretzky's account, is a matter of being connected to the facts in the right way, not having justifications for one's beliefs. More recently, Professor Dretzky has defended a representationalist account of the character of phenomenal experience, which holds that the content and quality of our conscious experiences depend in part on our biological histories. Conscious experience remains a focus of Professor Dretzky's ongoing research, including in particular the problem of understanding how knowledge of one's own conscious states is possible. Professor Dretzky's many influential publications include several books that have become classics in our field: Seeing and Knowing from 1969, Knowledge and the Flow of Information from 1981, Explaining Behavior from 1988, and Naturalizing the Mind from 1995. A selection of his influential philosophical essays, Perception, Knowledge, and Belief, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2000. And we're also, of course, delighted to welcome him to Berkeley today as this year's Howison lecturer. He'll be speaking to us on what we see.
Thank you very much, Jay. Well, as Jay mentioned, this has been a topic that has been with me for 40 years off and on, and I return to the topic now not because I've changed my mind, but because the view I espoused 40 years ago requires a much different sort of defense than it did 40 years ago. So much has happened in the last 20 or 30 years in psychology and cognitive neuroscience on perception that one can hardly advance anything without addressing some of the issues that are raised by that research. And so this is what I'm doing today. I'm giving you what Jay described as a view of non-epistemic seeing, but simultaneously trying to address some of these issues that arise in cognitive neuroscience. Now, I've got a subtitle here, The Texture of Conscious Experience, because I wanted to clarify that what I'm interested in here is what's going on in your head At the time you see something, I'm calling that a conscious experience, something you can extinguish just by closing your eyes and make reoccur by opening your eyes. It's that I want to talk about. What I'm interested in is what I'm calling the texture of that. I'm looking out at an audience. There are, I don't know how many people in this room, at least 100, say. How much of that richness that's in the world, how much of that detail, how much of that texture that's out there occurs in here in a conscious way when I look out at the world? That's the issue that I'm concerned with. And I'm concerned with that issue because recently, in the last 10 or 20 years, so many different strands of thought have started converging on the idea that our subjective impression of seeing so much detail and texture of the world in brief glances is an illusion. There is detail and texture out there, but it's an illusion to think that it occurs in here, and the illusion is fostered by the easy availability of details, because we can just flick our eyes around and pick up any information we care to, and the impression is fostered that all that detail that is so easily accessible in the world is occurring in the head, even during brief glances. And that is an illusion. Some of you perhaps know of Dan Dennett's well-known example of staring at a wall filled with Marilyn Monroe pictures, hundreds of pictures. And Dan says that it's hard to resist the feeling that you see hundreds of pictures just with a brief glance. But he says, no, that's a mistake. That's an illusion. There is that out in the world. It's not in your head. All that's in your head is the ability to access that detail by moving your eyes. So that's the kind of position I want to argue against. I've got just a few pictures here of some of the, these are just examples. You could, you all know that picture. Now, just looking at that very briefly for a few seconds, you have the impression of enormous detail. And you're aware of that detail. This is a street in New Delhi. This is not the night sky you'll see with the unaided eye. This is through the Hubble telescope. But just looking up at the night sky, the impression is you see hundreds, perhaps thousands of stars in one brief glance. And here's a pine forest in North Carolina. And the subjective impression is that just in a few seconds you see many, many trees. All right, let me start then by, and I'm going to start here by talking, I'm going to make some, philosophers love to do this, and I'm going to do it, make some distinctions, some linguistic distinctions, because you can't talk about visual perception without at least at the outset making it clear to your listeners exactly how you're going to use these words. So I'm going to start by saying that I'm going to use, I know psychologists and certainly neuropsychologists use perception to mean, roughly speaking, the pickup of usable information from the light by the eyes without any preconception of whether that information is ever embodied in a conscious experience. So that, for example, down here, you have unconscious perception, perception of an object without awareness of that object, in such a thing as blind sight. I don't know how many of you are familiar with blind sight. It's a case where damage to the brain, the person denies seeing anything, but can be demonstrated to be picking up information that he can be that he uses in making certain choices, what are called forced choices. So when you ask him questions, he gets an amazingly number of those questions right about the stimulus, even though denying seeing anything. All right, that's blind sight. And then there's other discoveries in the last 20, 30 years, different streams in which visual information is processed, dorsal and ventral. Ventral is conscious, dorsal is not. But I'm going to be using the verb to see to mean conscious perception. When you pick up usable information about your environment with the eyes, and this information is given conscious embodiment, the kind of experience you're now having of me, I hope, a conscious experience. So when I talk about what you see, I'm not going to be talking about just getting information about something, but when that information gives rise to a conscious experience. All right, then, let's start by talking about the different things we see. We talk about seeing objects, sticks, stones, stars, people, houses, stop signs. And when I talk about seeing objects, I'm going to include, although they're not really objects, events, football games, movements. You see not only my hand, but the movement of my hand. I'm going to count those both as objects for this purpose. I'm going to treat as an object anything that exists or occurs at a particular place and time. So the movement of my hand occurs now in this room. So I'll count it as an object. All right, that's one thing we see, objects. We also speak of seeing properties of the objects we see. Color of his tie, the size of the house, position of his pawn, and I'm going to include as objects relations. We see three things, and we see one of them as between the other two, or on top of something, or inside of something. One thing occurs before another. We can see these relations between things. All right. Properties are what philosophers call abstract objects. They don't occur at a place and time. They are universals. Nonetheless, we speak of seeing them. I could see the color of his tie, the shape of his nose, the size of his car, and so on. All right. Thirdly, this is just an illustration of, in the top, we speak of seeing different objects and the same properties. That is, I've got Judy and Trudy as twins here. Supposing you see Judy, and she has an identical twin, Trudy. This is a case where you see different objects, but since they look exactly the same, you see the same properties. Same shape, same colors. Everything looks the same, so that the properties you're aware of are the same. Nonetheless, you're aware of different objects. You see different objects, see the same properties. On the bottom, we have seen the same object, but different properties. You have a white drum, then you bathe the white drum in blue light, so now what you're aware of is the same white drum, but what you're aware of is not the color white, but the color blue. That's the color you actually perceive. And then, of course, you squash the drum, and you see a different shape, and this is the final. This is the white drum at a great distance. At that distance, the white drum looks like just a black spot. You can barely see it. You might say to yourself, what is that I see over there? As you get closer, you can see perhaps that it's a white drum. But from that distance, it looks, its shape is not visible. Its color is not visible. Nonetheless, you do see the white drum. If you kept your eye on it and walked up, you would confirm that that's what you were seeing at a great distance. So this is just shows you the independence of seeing objects and properties. Finally, we speak of seeing facts. Now, the facts we see are simply the things that we come to know by seeing. I see that his tie is blue, that our keys are on the table, that what I see over there is a squirrel, that A and B are different or the same, that A is moving. Now, ordinarily the facts we see, the things we come to know by seeing, we come to know them by seeing objects and their properties. I see that his tie is blue. I see that fact. I come to know that fact by seeing an object, his tie, and a property, the color of his tie. And then, somehow magically, I know that his tie is blue. How do I know it? I can see that it's blue. I see a certain fact by seeing the object and the property of that object. Now, often, of course, we see facts that aren't facts about the objects we see. I see that I'm almost out of gas. My gas tank is almost empty. I see that not by seeing my gas tank or the gasoline in it, but by seeing the fuel gauge on the dashboard. So sometimes we see a fact about an object over here by seeing an object here and its properties that, as it were, tell us what's going on over there, carries information about that. That's what measuring instruments do for us, or photographs, or television, newspapers. I see that there's violence in the Middle East, not by witnessing the violence in the Middle East, but by reading the newspaper. All I see is the newspaper and the print, but I speak of myself as being able to see that certain thing is so in that way. All right. Now, those are the distinctions I want you to keep in mind, seeing objects, seeing properties, and seeing facts. And now I'm just going to list a few dangers, which over the years I've found are dangers if people don't keep those three things distinct. The first danger is, it's not really a danger, it's kind of only a danger for philosophers, but it's if you're a skeptic, you're going to end up as an idealist if you don't keep this distinctions in mind, because this is the way the argument would go. Supposing you're a skeptic. You say, I cannot be sure, I don't know for certain that what I'm aware of is a real apple. After all, I could be dreaming. Some Cartesian demon could be deceiving me. I could be hallucinating. I can't be sure, can't know. Therefore, when looking at a real apple, I cannot see that it is a real apple. I can't get knowledge by seeing the apple. Therefore, and here's where the confusion comes, I do not see a real apple. What is it that I am aware of then? Well, it must be a mental image, a sense datum, something mental in nature. Now, that's a progression from skepticism to a conclusion about what we see that confuses the facts, which you can't see, according to the skeptic, with the perception of objects. A fallacy that is simply a confusion of seeing two quite different things. Second danger, mistaking property blindness for object blindness. Now, we all know enough about the retina to know that in peripheral vision, you're blind to the colors of things in peripheral vision. They all land on rods, which have no color sensitivity. Now, one shouldn't conclude, however, that because you cannot see the color, a property of objects in peripheral vision or night vision, that therefore you cannot see the colored objects in peripheral vision. It doesn't follow that because I can't see the blueness of that object over there, that I can't see the blue object over there. That would be confusing the properties of it with the thing that has those properties. And although I may not be able to see the color, maybe even not the shape of objects over there in extreme peripheral vision, it doesn't follow that I don't see those objects. And finally, and this is a danger, I think, with people who do the kind of experiments with change blindness that perhaps many of you are familiar with. Some people are careful in describing the results of these experiments, but I think some people tend to be careless. And so I just want to call attention to the fact that we don't want to mistake ignorance of or failure to notice or detect objects and properties as a failure to see them. So this is the way one might commit this fallacy. You say that a subject does not see, detect, or notice the difference between stimulus A and stimulus B. That is, does not see the fact that they differ. All right, so they're blind to a certain fact, the fact that A and B differ. What do you conclude from that? That they are blind to the objects or properties that make them different? That's to confuse a fact with an object or property. You should not confuse the perception of facts, the fact that A and B differ, with the perception of the objects and properties that make A and B differ. Now, I'm going to come back to change blindness a little later with some examples, because I think it's change blindness or results like that that convince many people that they see less than they might otherwise suppose they see. All right, here's a case of change blindness. I'm going to show you this for a few seconds, and I'm going to show you that for a few seconds. Did you all see the difference between those two figures? Now, if you're like me, you probably didn't see the difference. I'll even show them to you again, although. All right, here was the first figure. Here's the second figure. Now, perhaps some of you spotted the difference then. But supposing you didn't, then there's a certain fact you didn't see, the fact that those two arrays were different. Next question. Did you see the object? And here I just have, I'll call the object Sam. Sam was in the second array. It wasn't in the first. Now, question. I know you didn't see the difference, but that's not the question. I'm not interested in what facts you saw. I'm interested in what objects you saw. Did you see Sam the second time? The fact that you didn't see that Sam was a new object in the array is irrelevant. One should not conclude from the fact that you didn't see that there was a difference to the conclusion that you didn't see the object that made the difference. Now, I'm going to argue that your conscious experience when viewing the second array was different than it was the first time. It had a richer texture. It, in fact, had a representation of Sam, even if you didn't realize that it did, even if you didn't notice, could not detect that your conscious experience was different. It was different, even though you weren't capable of noticing or detecting the difference. One point about the texture of your conscious experience. The facts you see don't contribute in any way to the texture of your experience. Amy and Arnie see the same object, a sunflower, or a bunch of sunflowers, and the flowers look the same to both of them. They see the same properties. Yet Amy sees that it is a sunflower. She sees this fact that it is a sunflower. And Arnie, ignorant of such things, does not see that fact. Yet their conscious experience is the same, even though the facts they see are quite different. What this illustrates is that it's the objects and properties you see that constitute the texture of your conscious experience. The facts you see are irrelevant. And I think most people intuit this, that fact perception starts after you see objects and properties. Then the mind does something with its visual experience and manufactures knowledge out of it. But whether it manufactures that knowledge or not doesn't itself necessarily change the experience which that knowledge comes out of. Often, of course, the texture of your conscious experience is made different because you see more objects the second time than you do the first time. But sometimes you can see the same objects and a different texture is there because of properties of those objects. Here are nine squares or boxes. Supposing these boxes are piled up, you see all nine boxes. Then you see the same nine boxes, they're all painted blue. And they're bunched together so closely you can't even see their edges. Now, I'm going to claim you see all nine boxes here. Of course, you can't see their edges.
You see this box, although you don't see its edges.
If someone wants to argue, and perhaps someone will, someone always does, argue that you don't see the nine boxes there, I'm going to ask, which box don't you see? And if you say, I don't see this one, I'm wondering what your visual experience is like if you can't see this box. Do you see what's behind that box? I don't think you do. I think that box is occluding what's ever behind it. And if it occludes what's behind it, you must see it. Well, this then raises the question, which I think is the important question for my purposes. This is a question that's bothered me for a long time now, because what I've given you so far is a view of object perception and property perception, which makes what you know, what you detect, what you notice irrelevant to what you see. Even if you don't detect it, even if you don't notice it, even if you don't know that you're seeing different things, even if you don't see the difference, the fact that there is a difference, you still might see the objects and properties that make the difference. You just don't realize you do. Well, if that's the conclusion of the first part of this talk, then the question arises, and I've been asked this question often enough, well, Fred, what then makes your perception of something conscious if you don't have to even realize that you're conscious of something to be conscious of it? What kind of test can we use for a conscious perception of an object if the person who's doing the perceiving doesn't even have to know that they're conscious of something? There used to be a problem of other minds. How do we know other bodies are inhabited by minds? This looks like it's starting to produce a problem of one's own mind. That is, how does one find out about one's own conscious experience that one is in fact conscious of things if one doesn't have to notice them or detect them to be conscious of them? That's a serious question. It's a serious question if you want to do a science of consciousness, of conscious experience. Because without some kind of test, without some way of telling that a person is conscious of something, it looks like this question of whether they're conscious of it just doesn't get any traction at all. Sounds like a philosopher's question, not a question that scientists can legitimately raise. All right, so that's the question that I'm now going to address. And I'm going to propose to you a test. All right, this is a test for seeing objects. I'm going to suggest a simple-minded test here. I mean, it's based on this idea, why is your experience of me conscious? Because it gives you knowledge of me. You know, I've got a blue jacket on, I'm waving my hands around, I'm standing up behind. There's all kinds of things you know about me right now. And the reason you know them about me is because you can see me. You're conscious of me and of various properties of me, giving you knowledge. So the proposed test is that you're conscious of an object if, for appropriate values of the property symbol F, a person directly sees and therefore knows the fact that X is F. Your experience of an object is conscious if it gives you knowledge of that object. This is the test. I'm going to try to explain some of those key words a little more detail in a moment, but that I wanted to give you the capsule statement of the view anyway. So consciousness of an object if gives you conscious knowledge of that object. This isn't circular, because I'm defining consciousness of objects in terms of conscious knowledge of facts about that object. So the idea was this. I'm now going through that little toy example of change blindness. Here was the first. Here was the second. Now, I'm claiming
you knew something about Sam
when you saw that second figure. What did you know about Sam? Well, that he was the same color as the other ones. He was blue. He wasn't red. You knew that, in fact, not only
of Sam, but you knew that of all the objects in that array.
That none of them were red. This is what it would have looked like if Sam had been red. You would have spotted it immediately. Now, you know Sam wasn't red. You know and knew when you saw it that none of them were red. In fact, you knew also that none of them were star-shaped. You knew something about each and every object in that array, that it wasn't red and that it wasn't star-shaped. If you knew something about each and every object in that array, then you must have seen each and every object in that array according to this test for awareness. Now, this test for awareness is not just an informational test, that you're aware of something, conscious of something, if you get information, usable information about it, because the blindsiders don't know about the objects they perceive without being conscious of them. They get the right answers when they're forced to choose, but they take themselves to be guessing. With you, there was no guessing about that. You knew, I suggest, when you saw those array of objects, that none of them were red. Some piece of knowledge about each and every object in that 30-element array. There was no guessing about it. Now, let me explain a bit about that test. You have to be careful in applying this test, and here I'm making some philosophical moves. I know you can know something about an object without seeing it. I gave you already examples. I know things about my gas tank without ever seeing it. I know things about where George Bush is without seeing him. I read the newspaper, so I know things where our president is. He's back in Texas or something. Often, of course, we know things about objects without seeing them. So when applying this test, I mean, the information from the object has to be direct, not delivered via some intermediary like an instrument or a message or a photograph or a television image or something. So the information you get from an object has to be direct. Like, I can get information about you without ever seeing you. I look into an empty room and I know you're not in there. So I know something about you, that you're not in this room, because I look in the room, it's empty. Does that mean, according to this test, that I see you because I now know something about you by looking in the room? No, because I know something about you not by the way you look, but by the way the room looks. The information is not delivered directly. All right, one more example to illustrate the way this test is supposed to be applied. Fido has fleas, and I'm told that he has fleas. I can't see any of the fleas, but I'm, let's say, know that he has fleas. Now, I look at Fido, and I can see that none of the fleas on Fido are as big as a basketball. I just look. Somebody says, how big are those fleas? I say, well, I don't know how big they are, but I know none of them are as big as a basketball. I can just see that. If they were as big as a basketball, I could see the flea, but I can't see the fleas. So I know they're not. Now, that's a misapplication of the test, because the size of something affects its visibility. If you make something bigger, you make it easier to see. Color and shape don't affect an object's visibility. That's why I use examples only of color and shape. If you change the color of something, you change its noticeability. If you make, among those blue objects, if you make one of them red, you'll notice it right away. It'll pop out, as they say. But by changing the color of something from blue to red, you don't make it visible. You just make it noticeable. Likewise, if I look into a room of people and someone's naked in the room, I notice them immediately. But taking off the clothes doesn't make them visible. It just makes them noticeable. And, you know, someone with clothes on in a nudist colony would be very noticeable. But once again, changing, removing or putting clothes on doesn't change an object's visibility. It just changes its noticeability. So when you apply this test, I ask you to keep that in mind, that I'm only going to deal with properties that you can know that something has that don't affect the thing's visibility, just noticeability. All right, one more last comment before I come to the example that I'm really after here. And that's about the kind of knowledge that I'm talking about. I'm claiming you knew something about each and every element in that multi-element array. Now, this is a funny, perhaps, use of the word knowledge, but let me give you an illustration of the kind of knowledge I have in mind. I was out to dinner with a person the other night, and perfectly ordinary dinner, and the next day had someone ask me, they didn't, but supposing someone the next day asked me, well, did your friend have a hat on during dinner? I'd say, no. How do you know? Well, I sat right across from the table, and I could see that he didn't have a hat on. And they said, did you think about that at the moment? Did you think to yourself, gee, he doesn't have a hat on? I said, no, at the time I didn't think that, but now that you raised the issue, I know he didn't, and I didn't just learn he didn't. I knew since last night he didn't, because I saw him. I could see that he didn't have a hat on. See, the idea here is I knew something about my friend that he didn't have a hat on last night, even though the first time I even thought about that was when my friend raised the question. Then I said, well, yes, he didn't have a hat on. That's how I know that when I got up this morning, there weren't any giraffes in my bedroom. You know, if someone, I didn't think about giraffes this morning when I got up. I didn't think that at all. But if someone asked me, were there any in your bedroom this morning? I'd say, no. How do you know, Fred? Well, I can remember what my room looked like this morning. There just weren't any giraffes in it. I didn't just learn there weren't any giraffes when you asked me. Now, what this suggests is you don't have to kind of actively think something to know it. The knowledge you get, I'm going to call this tacit knowledge, if you will. There's a great many things you know tacitly, not because when you acquire the knowledge you're actually thinking about it or believing it, but because you have the kind of experience of it, which, if you do later think about it, will tell you what you need to know. So that's how I know my friend last night was not wearing a hat at dinner the other night, because when I'm asked about it, I can recall what he looked like, and I know he didn't have a hat on. And that's why I know and knew since this morning that there were no giraffes in my bedroom. All right, that's the kind of knowledge I'm attributing to you about that multi-element array. When you saw that array, you didn't think to yourself, gee, none of those elements are red. None of them are star-shaped. Nonetheless, once I removed the array and asked you, Were any of them red? Were any of them star-shaped? You could tell me authoritatively on the basis of what you saw that none of them were. You had that knowledge. Call it tacit knowledge, but it was knowledge. All right. What I'm going to show you now is a brick wall. Think of it as a brick wall. Of course, it's just a picture. But it's going to be very complex, that it's going to have at least 350 elements in it, 350 bricks. I'm going to show it to you for a couple seconds. Then I'm going to show it to you again, and it's going to be different. And I don't know, some of you may see the difference, but nobody I've ever shown this to has ever seen the difference. So test yourself. And you see the difference. All right. Now the question here is not whether you saw the difference, because seeing the difference is seeing the fact that those images were different, and I'm assuming none of you saw that fact. But I'm not now interested in what facts you saw. I'm interested in what bricks you saw. Because what I want to know is whether there was in your head a conscious experience of all those bricks, whether your conscious experience was as rich and textured as is the image on this screen. And I want to argue that it was. All right, how do I argue that it was? By suggesting that you know something about each and every brick in that wall. What do you know about each and every brick in the wall? Well, you know, this is the added brick, by the way. Call that brick Sam. That's a brick that was there the second time. It wasn't there the first time. Now, I think you know something about, or when you saw the second figure, you knew something about Sam. And in fact, you knew something about every brick in that wall. What did you know? Well, I've given away the kind of thing I'm going to claim you knew. You knew, for instance, that none of them were blue. This is what the wall would have looked like had Sam been blue. And you would have spotted Sam immediately if Sam had been blue. So you know Sam wasn't blue. In fact, you know they were all orange. You know that none of them were blue. And you know, in fact, that none of them were tilted. They were all horizontal. You would have spotted a tilted one. So this is what you knew when you saw the second figure. That each and every brick in that wall was orange. I'm not using orange very strictly here. Just think of orange as not blue or black or all the other colors it might have been. Let's just say that it wasn't blue. And it was horizontal, that it wasn't tilted like this. Those are things you knew about the bricks, each brick. Now, I've got to argue here that not only did you know that about Sam, but you knew it about each and every brick in that wall. And the argument's going to be fairly straightforward. I'm going to claim that you had 350 distinct pieces of knowledge, one for each brick in the wall. Now, you didn't have one piece of knowledge of something general in nature. You didn't know that none of the bricks in the wall were blue or tilted. You didn't have that general piece of knowledge because you couldn't see whether those were all the bricks in the wall. For all you know, I gave you a snapshot of one part of the wall, and maybe there were other parts that you couldn't see in which there were blue and tilted bricks. So you couldn't see that none of the bricks in the wall were blue or tilted because you couldn't see that you were seeing all the bricks. Nonetheless, if those were all the bricks in the wall, and I assure you they were, then you could see of each and every one of them that none of them were blue or tilted. As I indicate, logicians express this. This is kind of de re knowledge versus de dicto. That for all X, if X is a brick in the wall, you could see that X was neither blue nor tilted. That's what you could see. Something about each and every brick in the wall. You do not see that for all X, if X is a brick in the wall, then it's neither blue nor tilted. You can't see something general in nature like that. But you do know something about each and every brick. But it's a distributive sense of all, not a collective sense of all. All right, conclusion. Therefore, those of you of normal vision. Now, this is not a priori philosophy. I don't know. I'm making a claim about everyone in this room that you all knew something about each and every brick in the wall. I don't know whether that's true or not, because I don't know that much about your individual visual capacities. Maybe some of you are colorblind. Maybe some of you could barely see the screen, let alone see each brick up there. Maybe some of you looked with only one eye and looked so briefly that some of the bricks fell on your blind spot and you didn't actually see some of the bricks. All kinds of things could have prevented individuals from seeing what I'm claiming people of normal vision would have seen if they look at. So this is an empirical claim I'm making, that if you had normal vision and if you looked for several seconds, by the way, is enough time for the eye to execute 6 or 7 saccades, making different parts of that brick wall fall on the sensitive part of the retina, the fovea. So if you looked at that brick wall for just 2 or 3 seconds, chances are the eye executed enough saccades to make most of the bricks, anyway, fall on that very sensitive, discriminating part of the retina. But this is an empirical claim I'm making. If it would have to be tested, what I would do is show you those brick walls, take each individual one by one, show you them again and again, and see if you could tell whether any brick was blue or tilted in a 2-second exposure. My bet is that people of normal vision will be able to tell and then know whether any brick in that wall is blue or tilted in 2-second exposures, no matter which brick we're talking about. If that's true of you, and whether it's true of you or not is an empirical question, then I'm going to claim you know something and could see that something was true of each and every brick in the wall. Hence, according to the proposed test for consciousness of an object, you are conscious of every brick in the wall, 350 different bricks. And that tells us something important about the texture, the richness of your conscious experience of a complex stimulus like a brick wall. And I think it tells us something about our everyday experiences of the complex stimuli we look at every day. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. I want to ask you, I don't know what you will say to the following proposition. You can sometimes see global facts about an array put in front of you without deriving that from your seeing of lots of local facts about the array. And what I mean is, for example, if you took your geometric display for change blindness and you asked us, is this symmetrical? You know, is there an axis about which this is symmetric? Then one way to do it would be to see where each and everything in the display is, to then write all that down, and then derive from that by some geometric calculation whether the thing is symmetric. But actually, that's not what we do. You just look, and at a glance, you can see this global fact, yeah. The display is symmetric. So let me just ask you, how do you feel about that, seeing a global facts about an array?
That sounds exactly right, the way you described that. In this case, you're seeing a fact about the set or the array,
yeah.
Not a fact about any individual in the array.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I wonder is, isn't everything in the array being the same color like that a global property of the array? You just look at it and you see, yeah, it's all the same color. But I didn't derive that from a lot of local facts about the color of this and the color of that and the color of that.
All right, yeah. Well, if you didn't derive it, see,
Well, the brick wall, if I put a piece of masking tape over any brick, I would destroy your knowledge that none of the bricks were blue or tilted. You could no longer tell. You would no longer be a reliable teller whether none of the bricks were blue or tilted because I had obscured an individual brick. I conclude from that, I conclude from that that it was, in part at least, the way that brick looked that told you what you now know about all the bricks, that none of them were blue or tilted. And if I obscure any brick in that wall, it's going to destroy the knowledge which you have. I take it that means that each brick looking some way to you was instrumental in what you came to know.
Okay. I see the move, but I won't go on indefinitely, but I see the move. But I guess what I wonder is if that is the right quantifier in all the bricks in the wall. I mean, what I see at a glance is that all the visible bricks are the same color. And if you occlude one, that's fine. It doesn't count anymore. It's no longer a visible brick. But what I'm still getting at a glance is this global property of the whole array. All the visible bricks are the same color. I mean, that, forgetting global properties of an array, vision is just going to tell you about what's visible.
Yeah.
You know, it will do its best.
Uh-huh.
And if you go around occluding things, well, it just packs up.
I guess this is good. I think what I have to argue here, I won't, is that this is not a global fact about the array. You're when you say you're able to tell something about the array that none of the visible ones, that seems to me a distributive claim about each and every brick. It's not a fact about, well, it adds up to a fact about all the visible ones, but the general fact that you reach comes from what you know about each and every brick. But nice question.
If you allow yourself to talk in such an unrestricted way about seeing facts, it looks like you're committed to saying that we see an infinite number of facts. Because if you can see that there are no giraffes in your bedroom, well, presumably you also saw there were no elephants, no aardvarks, no hippopotami, no Chevrolet station wagons, etc. And you saw that there weren't three giraffes, there weren't four giraffes, et cetera. So it looks like you got an infinite number.
Yeah.
That's an enormous visual capacity. And then my second question is, one feels uncomfortable with your handling of the change blindness cases because it looks like there's some sleight of hand involved. And I wonder how you would deal with cases like the change blindness experiment where they throw the basketball and then the guy walks through wearing an orangutan costume. Are you committed to the view that you do see the guy even though you were not aware of it?
Yeah.
And how do you deal? What's the knowledge you get?
Well, that he wasn't wearing a clown suit or, you know. I don't know. I would have to find something you knew about the gorilla. All right, this John's alluding to the kind of change blindness experiment where subjects are asked to watch people throwing basketballs and concentrate on how many passes this team made. And while they're doing this, somebody dressed in a gorilla costume walks through the scene and exits, and people have said, "Did you notice anything funny going on?" Often people say, "No, I didn't see anything. What's funny?" I was with a group that the woman next to me said, she says, "What's everyone?" We all knew when we were watching for the gorilla. So, but she said she didn't see the gorilla. Now, John's asking me, Am I going to claim she did see the gorilla, just didn't notice him? I think it's likely she did see him, didn't notice him. It's like my wife at the farmer's market. I did see her. I just didn't notice her. I thought she was wearing a red sweater, so I didn't pay any attention to the blue sweaters and so on. Yep, I did see her. I think this person was concentrating on the passes, just didn't notice that gorilla. How I would argue it, given the thesis here, I would have to show that there's something the person knew about the gorilla that could be demonstrated. And I don't know what that would be. I'd have to think up something. But your first question was, yeah.
It relates to the first question. Namely, it looks like it's going to be some negative thing that you know. She wasn't as big as a Cadillac station wagon, because if she had been, then you would have noticed her,
yeah.
The gorilla. But then it looks like, now if we allow ourselves to talk in an unrestricted way about seeing negative facts, it looks like you see an infinite number of negative facts whenever you open your eyes.
Yeah, but I'm not worried about all this knowledge, since it all comes free, kind of. That is, given that you don't have to believe it, no active belief, because that's the sense in which the guy I was having dinner with last night, I knew he wasn't wearing a hat. Well, I knew he wasn't naked. I knew he wasn't in a clown costume. You know, and all these infinite things, but they all come free, because the information which supports the knowledge claim was all there in the experience, and that's what tacit knowledge is. Knowing things which is supported by the experience, in this case, the remembered experience. You've got to remember the experience enough. If you forget what he looked like, and somebody says, was he wearing a hat? You say, I don't think so, but I actually don't remember. I wasn't paying that much attention to him. But if you were paying attention, then you know. And that's a free piece of knowledge. And if it's free, that free, infinite doesn't matter. You get it all.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.